Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Regina. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, What's New in Precision Medicine. And today's program is supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb, Foundation Medicine, and AstraZeneca. And I really want to thank them for their support. I just want to, before I start the program today, I just want to acknowledge that we have over 200 participants on the call today. You come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Belgium, Canada, Israel, and United Kingdom. So it is a global call as well. And it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Leonard Saltz. And Dr. Saltz is medical oncologist, executive director for clinical value and sustainability, head colorectal oncology section, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine while at Cornell Medicine. And Dr. Saltz will be addressing understanding of precision medicine, overview of value of of precision medicine, and the role of precision medicine in deciding the treatment for colon cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Saltz.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you today. Precision medicine is a term that's thrown around a lot, and I think a lot of people have difficulty understanding what we're talking about. We used to conflate the term with the idea of personalized medicine, and partially that is the case. I tend to think of personalized medicine as just good medicine, which means clinicians speaking with the patient and understanding the patient's values, priorities, and preferences to help guide therapy. For example, a personalized part of medicine may be if I have two reasonable options for treatment, but they have different side effect profiles, I can work with the patient to understand which side effect profile would be more problematic or more acceptable to the patient. Precision medicine talks about trying to understand more accurately what is going on in the cancer, what is driving the cancer, and what can we do to fight the cancer more effectively. So in that respect, what we do in the concept of precision medicine often involves looking at the specific mutations that have happened in the cancer itself to understand what is driving the cancer, what mutations might be targets, so to speak, for attack, and then hoping to combine that kind of thing with an appropriate drug that would go after that target. Now, the concept of precision medicine needs to be understood both in a positive and a negative aspect. The positive use of precision medicine or inclusionary use would be finding a target that you can attack when you have a drug that you can use for it. A negative effect would be seeing something in the tumor that tells you that a drug won't work. So a drug that you might have thought about giving, in fact, because of the presence of a particular mutation in the tumor, you can say, well, not in this individual patient because this drug won't work because our precision analysis says that this is the wrong tumor for it, even if it might be the case. Excuse me. And that gets to the concept of what is the value of this approach. The value to the patient is maximizing the chance that the drug that you're accepting is going to have the desired benefit. Because, of course, all of the drugs that we have carry a certain amount of risk of side effects, and we want to maximize the benefit to side effect or risk ratio. Now, in terms of the particular things we think about in colorectal cancer, which is the area that I tend to focus on most in terms of patient care. The most important precision decision is understanding the concept of mismatch repair, proficiency, or microsatellite instability. They're really two ways of saying the same thing. But we talk about colorectal cancer is divided into the common type, where it's mismatch repair proficient versus the uncommon type that is mismatch repair deficient. What we're referring to in proficient and deficient is the presence of these repair enzymes that correct base mismatches in the DNA in the tumor. The reason that we care so much for the most part is if a patient's colorectal cancer is mismatch repair deficient, also sometimes referred to as MSI or microsatellite instable, that's the subgroup that really comes from a treatment called immunotherapy, a kind of approach where we use drugs that enhance the immune system and have the immune system do the attacking on the tumor. If a patient has a mismatch repair proficient, or also known as microsatellite stable colon cancer, then the currently available immunotherapies are completely ineffective, and we use the more standard types of chemotherapy to attack that tumor. Now, the next area that we look at in terms of precision medicine and colorectal cancer is in the KRAS and NRAS mutations. These are genes that are involved in potentially sending signals to the cell that tell it to grow and survive. And of course, we don't want cancer cells to grow and survive. So certain drugs that we have will have a high likelihood of being effective if the RAS genes, the KRAS and NRAS genes, are normal or non-mutated. Whereas if those genes are mutated, then a certain class of drugs will not be effective. And so that, again, can spare a patient unnecessary treatment with a drug that won't work and let us move on to try something else. Now, we've thought about KRAS for years as a target that we can't really do much about. That's a bad thing to have because certain drugs won't work at it. But now we're starting to see precision medicine finding ways to go after certain KRAS treatments. And so we have to get even more precise and look at what are the different mutations that we see in KRAS. And there's one in particular that goes by the designation G12C. That's G as in golf, 12, C as in Charlie. And the G12C mutation now has drugs on the market that can be quite beneficial for those patients. But those drugs only work in a KRAS G12C mutation, not in a G13 or not in a G12D mutation, for example. So it's very precise. It's like trying to get the right cartridge for your printer. All the numbers have to match up exactly or it won't work. The other gene that has become very important in understanding in colorectal cancer is called BRAF, B-R-A-F. And yet the majority of patients will not have a BRAF mutation, but about 8% or 8 out of 100 patients with colon cancer will have a BRAF mutation. And if that is present, then we have drug therapies that can be particularly useful for BRAF and will be completely useless unless that BRAF mutation is present. So again, understanding this is important. The last major target that we think about in colorectal cancer is HER2. HER2 is a target that is often amplified in breast cancer, and we've only recently come to understand that a small percentage of colon cancer patients have a HER2 amplification, and that guides our therapy because we can use HER2-targeted therapy in a way that can be beneficial to patients, but also knowing that if there's overexpression of HER2, then certain other drugs that we might use won't work. So again, precision medicine gives and it takes away. It gives certain options, it closes off other options, but it's not really closing off an option, it's simply telling us that option was never there in the first place, so don't subject the patient to the side effects of that treatment. Go on and try something else. Now, we go about finding these precision targets one of two ways. We either do what's called a next-generation sequencing on the tumor itself, where we need a sample of the tumor, and that can be done through a number of commercial laboratories or through centers like the one I work at have our own in-house assay. Many of these are equivalent and useful. In some patients, we don't have enough of a tumor sample to do that, and we can get the information off what's become known as a liquid biopsy. This is just a blood test, but it's a blood test where we remove the DNA from the tumor from a sample of blood and analyze that to understand the mutational profile. These are equally effective, and if we have adequate information from one, we don't necessarily need the other. But this is sort of an overview of the idea of how understanding more and more about the specific cancer lets us be more precise in selecting the chemotherapy treatment that will give us the best possible outcome. Now, one of the things I'm going to say about colon cancer, you're going to hear differently from some of my colleagues who are going to talk about other cancers. In colon cancer, once we've done this kind of precision analysis or molecular analysis, we really haven't seen benefit to doing it again. We don't see development of ongoing new mutations that become effective targets that can be used for treatment. So whereas you're going to hear about that being different in some types of cancers, in colorectal cancer, once we have that analysis, it pretty much gives us the answer. Whether we're happy with it or not happy with it, doing it again doesn't really provide real value or benefit for patients. I'll mention one last target, and that is the NTRK, N-T-R-K, which is something that is kind of routinely now looked for in just about every cancer. It's an extremely rare mutation. It's in one of several thousand individuals that have colorectal cancer, but there are potentially effective drugs. And so knowing about that is important for those individuals. What's important to understand is that nowadays we pretty much do this kind of precision medicine on a panel of genes so that we're looking for all of these possible mutations in all of the patients so that we pick up the rare ones, because whereas for a general population it may not make a big difference, for an individual it can create an important treatment option. In the interest of time, I'm going to stop there to make sure that my colleagues have time to give their talks, and then I'd be happy to take any questions at the end of this program. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Saltz. That was really a really outstanding presentation and really set the stage for today's program to some extent, really identifying and defining what precision medicine is and how it invaluable it is. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. And Dr. Morrow is leader myeloproliferative neoplasms program, member Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor Weill Cornell Medicine. And Dr. Morrow will be addressing how precision medicine is different from targeted treatments, the role of precision medicine in deciding treatment for people living with leukemia, and how precision medicine contributes to treatment options and quality of life. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Morrow.
Thanks, Carolyn, and thank you everyone for joining us. And that is a tough act to follow. A wonderful introduction from Dr. Saltz. So I'm a leukemia physician at the same center as Dr. Saltz at Memorial Sloan Kettering. And I'm going to cover, as he had mentioned, some of the specifics that are related to blood cancers, perhaps, for a bit more, or at least a perspective in treating blood cancers. But I think we can use blood cancers as a paradigm to answer these questions. The first point would be, how is precision medicine different than targeted treatments? And I fear I might say some of the same things Dr. Schultz said, or many of us might say, in trying to tease out these two terms. But if we go back in time, I have worked a lot in the field of chronic myeloid leukemia, which is a rarer blood cancer, but one that is felt to have set a really good example for how, quote, targeted therapy can be very successful. Turn back the hands of time to 1998, and a small clinical trial building on the basic science saying that all patients with CML had a Philadelphia chromosome, which was an abnormal genetic mark, which produced an abnormal protein called BCR-ABL. And prior to that time, chemotherapy that was broadly active was used to treat chronic myeloid leukemia. And the idea was, could we target BCR-ABL, which would be present in all of the patients with CML, as a better treatment than chemotherapy, which wasn't very specific? And at that time, there weren't many targeted cancer drugs. Things were focusing on commonalities between the cancer, or commonalities that were cleaner and easier and probably more effective ways of treating the cancer. Examples included hormone treatment for prostate cancer and breast cancer, because most prostate cancer and breast cancer types were, those cells required and or were sort of addicted to hormones to survive. A target Dr. Schultz mentioned called HER2, which is something that's overexpressed and drives cancers of, now we know, many types. That, with regards to targeted therapy, at that time when CML was being developed, those were the kind of targeted drugs we had. We had a really small list. These were antibodies or hormone compounds, so they weren't conventional chemical chemotherapy compounds, which were often had more side effects. They were the first targeted therapy. So CML led the way of showing that targeted therapy, finding something that's common that would be a much more efficient way of treating the cancer, was very effective. And there's now a number of what are called tyrosine kinase inhibitors, drugs that target BCR-ABL, which help patients with CML tremendously, really have increased the deep remission rate and even have allowed us to have a functional cure now in CML. And we continue to develop new drugs, including one which was just further developed called asciminib, which may be our best drug ever. But back to my task. So how does that differ from precision medicine? Now, we heard from Dr. Schultz about how we can take biopsies of the tumor. In blood cancers, we have ready material easily accessible from the blood and sometimes from the bone marrow, but we have plenty of access to the tumor type. And precision medicine there, and I can talk about how we use the next point, how we decide to treat leukemia better using precision medicine. We may start by recognizing that cancers have something in common, but then we say, well, what's specific about this one? Let's say we're talking about cars. They all have an engine and tires and wheels. But is this a fuel-injected car, or is this, say, an electric car, or is this a car that runs on diesel? You know, how are we going to approach this cancer type by understanding what makes that specific tumor type tick? And in acute myeloid leukemia, I think a great example has also come to pass. It was a trial called the BEAT AML trial, great name. But what we did there, and we meaning hundreds of investigators throughout the AML community, supported by our partners in the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, we took patients who had just been diagnosed with leukemia and quickly sent their tumors for precision medicine testing, where we found, aha, this cancer, this AML in this patient, runs on diesel, is turbocharged, has dual injectors. I'm sorry about the car analogy, I'm not a mechanic, but it had specific features, had specific targets. And from there, we tested and now have a number of precision medicine approaches in acute myeloid leukemia. Some examples include IDH inhibitors. IDH is an enzyme called isocitrate dehydrogenase, which is a normal enzyme in cells that it uses during its normal metabolic pathway, kind of its normal machinery. But if it's deregulated, it leads to leukemia by a number of different pathways. There are two drugs that can block this IDH if it's abnormal. And the key here is identifying that that tumor has a mutation in IDH and therefore would be very suitable to be sensitive to and be killed by an IDH inhibitor. Now, that's not going to be the case if you gave an IDH inhibitor to someone whose tumor did not have an IDH mutation. So that's maybe the crux of precision medicine, is knowing that it's AML and it may have a number of broad targets, and we can use other medicines which are broader. But in these specific cases, we can use drugs like that. Venetoclax, a BCL2 inhibitor, is a little bit more of a hybrid between precision and targeted therapy, but is used broadly in leukemia, as well as other many leukemias, really. But that drug both is targeted in that it's hitting an oncogene or an anti-apoptotic gene, we call it, something that keeps cancer cells alive longer than healthy cells, but it's very powerful in combination with our precision medicine targeted drugs, and really has given us a lower side effect and more efficient way of treating AML. There are many other targets, including some newer antibodies, like the earlier drugs you mentioned, like Herceptin, which is an antibody related to the HER2 target, or rituximab, which is a drug used in lymphoid cancers. And the precision medicine target list, and now I'm using both terms in the same sentence, it grows. You know, we're finding new things that are specific to certain patients with the same type of blood cancer, where we can profile it better and better treat that patient's leukemia. Now, Dr. Saltz made another important point. In blood cancers, the tumor can evolve quickly, or it can evolve under our watch. That doesn't mean we can't treat it. It just means that we do sometimes see what we call subclones or subpopulations. We may treat, and this is a terrible analogy too, but we may, you know, rid the property of all the grass, but the weeds can remain. So now we have to profile the weeds and understand why are they different, why are they persisting, or why are they now trying to take over our beautiful garden. So these are some of the principles in acute myeloid leukemia and chronic leukemias that are related to precision medicine and target medicine. The last point to cover might be how it contributes to treatment options and quality of life. The beauty of most of the newer drugs we strive to develop is that they often are coming in a different form of delivery, meaning they often can be oral or more acceptable intravenous or other means of delivering drugs that are a little bit less hard on the patient or the healthy cells that we're trying not to hurt. And if they're ideal, they may be very narrow, targeted, if you will, or precise, and that they're taking down just the cells that are dependent on, driven by, addicted to certain things, and not hurt any other healthy cells. I mean, that's the ideal drug. And we're getting closer and closer. I think the example in CML was a very good one. And as you're going to hear more from other colleagues, and Dr. Saltz mentioned, there are many different pathways. And cancer is now such a multifaceted story that these are really our mainstay. We don't often think of cancer treatment using general terms, general regimens, or general principles. We do always strive for targeted and precision treatments. And quality of life is going to improve by better remission rates, better methods of delivery, often treatment that can be given in or out of the hospital in many cases, and, of course, better outcomes. I'll stop there, and thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Morrow. That was a wonderful presentation, really stellar, and really, I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Just really, these presentations are just incredible for people to understand more about precision medicine, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Alyssa Cooper, and Dr. Cooper is thoracic oncologist, assistant attending physician, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Cooper will be addressing talking with your healthcare team about precision medicine and its benefits, the role of precision medicine in deciding the treatment for lung cancer, and guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology and prepared list of questions. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Cooper.
Thanks so much for having me on this program. It's really a pleasure to speak with all of you and with my colleagues as well. I thought I'd start out with the role of precision medicine in deciding the treatment for lung cancer. Precision medicine, or matching specific treatments based on alterations found in the tumors, was initially recognized as having importance in lung cancer. Actually, this is the 20th anniversary this year of the discovery of the EGFR gene, so a very important gene in lung cancer, and this is the 20th anniversary, and is now absolutely paramount in the standard of care for lung cancer. So nowadays, the standard of care for newly diagnosed lung cancer is to test for genetic changes in the cancer that may have a matched targeted treatment, And in the U.S., there are 10 alterations in lung cancer for which there are FDA-approved treatments, which is a huge explosion from prior. In many cases, if a matched targeted treatment is found, this could be the recommended first-line therapy for patients with advanced disease. So it's vitally important that these tests are performed before a treatment decision is made. In addition, some of these alterations with matched treatments need a deeper level of gene sequencing than is done by some standard tests. So one of the things I'll emphasize later on is that patients should feel empowered to ask their doctors to make sure all of the appropriate testing has been done. Our practice has now changed even in the past few years, as testing is now extended to patients with earlier stages of disease rather than just for patients with advanced disease. Targeted treatments have been incorporated into treatment plans for patients undergoing surgery, with studies recently showing significant benefit when patients take these pills after surgery is completed. Just within the last week, there has also now been benefits shown in a study of patients with an alteration in the EGFR gene when they take the targeted treatment after they undergo chemo and radiation. This means that patients with lung cancer, even in the earlier stages, should have genetic testing and full genetic testing performed on their tumors. Other than targeted pills, one of the most basic forms of precision medicine in lung cancer is looking at the expression of something called PD-L1, a protein on the surface of the cancer cells, which can tell us how likely is it that a patient's tumor will respond to immunotherapy. These numbers range from percents from 0 to 100%. And though we know they're not perfect, they can usually give us a rough idea of how well immunotherapy might be expected to work. But we really need to understand more about this biomarker so we can give patients a clearer idea of what to expect from treatment. We're starting to learn more about specific mutations that might predict that a specific cancer might not respond as well to immunotherapy, though we're not quite as at the point of making clinical treatment decisions based on that. There's also a new form of drugs called antibody drug conjugates, which have just been developed over the last couple of years. This is a special kind of chemotherapy attached to a molecule that will direct towards targets on tumors. One kind of targeted antibody drug conjugate has been approved in lung cancer, actually against the HER2 protein that both my colleagues were referencing, and others are expected to follow suit. That means that there's many multiple new choices of treatments in lung cancer. We're still learning about how precision medicine plays a role in these specific antibody drug conjugates, which generally target a protein on the cell's surface, not on a genetic change. For some of these treatments, we're not sure if it matters how much of that protein is expressed on the cancer cell or if you just need to have some present in order to see good efficacy. One area that's most in its infancy of lung cancer is using blood markers during a patient's treatment, like the genetic material from the cancer cells that my colleagues were discussing, to predict outcomes, both in response to treatment and overall. This is really being investigated deeply in research studies, and as we know, this is used regularly in clinical care for patients with other cancers, such as colon cancer and leukemia, but is not quite ready for prime time in lung cancer until more studies are completed. So in terms of talking with your healthcare team, I think if there's anything I hope people take away from this teleconference, it's to empower patients, families, and caregivers to ask their doctors and their care teams about the genetic and other testing that has been performed on their tumor tissue and what it signifies for their current and future treatment options. For patients with lung cancer specifically, I'd like to make patients aware that there are two levels of genetic testing and both are not always performed. You can ask your doctors about DNA testing, which is the more common test and picks up most targetable genetic changes. However, there is something called RNA testing, which is not always done, and it is used for some of the more important genetic changes in lung cancer, such as in ALK, RET, and ROS1. I'd also like to make patients aware that genetic testing can be done on a blood test, but this is not as sensitive as performing this testing on tumor tissue. So if the blood test is negative, you don't always know for sure if it's a true negative unless the test is performed on the tumor tissue as well. With regards to preparing for telehealth, it's really been an exciting development born out of necessity during COVID, but really continued giving convenience for patients in terms of time spent in the clinic, expense with getting to the clinic, parking, and missing work. I don't want to speak for every clinician, but many clinicians I know have a bit of a love-hate relationship with telehealth. On the one hand, it's extremely convenient, but on the other hand, it is a bit difficult to have the same kind of tough or in-depth conversations we sometimes need to have when people are in person. Before the appointment, I would recommend checking that you know how to work the app or the link, testing your sound or microphone, have someone with you who's facile with technology just in case. The last thing that anyone wants is to waste time with the visit trying to figure out the sound or the connection. But when it works out, it really is invaluable to everyone involved. In fact, there was just a study presented at a big conference 2 weeks ago that looked at whether palliative care telemed appointments were as good as in-person visits, and the study found that they were, that patients were overall as satisfied and their symptoms were as controlled as in person. And I think anything like this that can help patients live more of their normal lives outside of the clinic has given us a real advantage. Thanks.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Cooper. That was a superb presentation. Lots of information for participants, and I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. Thanks. And our next speaker is Dr. Jesse Cox. And Dr. Cox is Director, Tissue Typing HLA Laboratory, Nebraska Medicine, Director, Molecular Forensics Laboratory, UNMC, Medical Director, Nebraska Public Service Laboratory, UNC, Medical Director, Boys Town National Research Hospital, Omaha, Nebraska Association, Associate Director, Molecular Diagnostics Laboratory, Nebraska Medicine, Associate Professor, Department of Pathology and Microbiology, University of Nebraska Medical Center. And Dr. Cox will be addressing the role of the pathologist, asking your healthcare team and pathologist to help you understand open notes, and precision medicine's role in informing treatment decisions, predicting response to treatment. It's my pleasure now to introduce my esteemed colleague, Dr. Cox.
Thank you very much for the wonderful introduction. And so I have the distinct pleasure of introducing what a pathologist is for a lot of folks. So pathologists are medical doctors, but are largely our role is played behind the scenes. And so typically in the context of oncology and cancer, our job is to actually take the physical tissue that comes from a patient, be that a biopsy or an excisional sample and whatnot, and we're there to describe it and characterize it, look at those cells underneath the microscope to determine exactly what the disease process is that we're all dealing with. In particular, with regard to the gross dissection, pathologists are there to basically examine the tissue to help determine stage and grade of a particular cancer. So this could include things like tumor size, a tumor relationship to surrounding anatomy, relationship to surgical margin, so the plane where the surgeon actually cut to remove that cancerous element to make sure that no cancer is left behind in the body. And we also want to examine any other surrounding tissues that could be involved, and this could be things like lymph nodes. During that gross examination process, we'll actually go through and sample the tissue for further study microscopically or underneath the microscope. And so again, the microscopic exam is absolutely critical to determine what type of tumor is present. So it could be in the context of lung cancers. Could it be an adenocarcinoma? Could it be something like a squamous cell carcinoma? Could it be something called a small cell carcinoma? And so depending upon the tumor type, that's going to position patients kind of into different channels for their respective treatments. The other thing during a pathologic examination that we'll do is we'll perform special stains. So if there is a tumor where we're not quite sure where the primary site or where that tumor has been, we can use basically proteins that are expressed by the cancer to help characterize its site of origin. Again, that can be useful for further staging, for further treatments, and those types of things. And lastly, probably most critical to the discussion here today, pathologists are involved with examining the tumor DNA and RNA to look for those mutations which may be actionable and important for things like prognosis or diagnosis or, again, the kind of the treatment and personalization and precision therapies decisions for these patients. So ultimately, the pathologist provides the diagnosis that underpins all subsequent therapy for that patient. So all of this information and data basically gets compiled together in pathology reports. And so with recent legislation has been passed to basically ensure that patients have direct access to their medical documents, including the pathologist reports via open notes. So if you have to go through and look at your pathology report, much of the information that's included in that report is there to fully characterize and stratify the patient's disease process as it pertains to basically that staging information. Again, this is important for things like prognosis and determining what best next therapies and things like that are going to be for both the surgeons and the oncologists who are treating those patients. Oftentimes, a lot of this information is utilized towards different guidelines to help stratify, again, to determine best next steps. If you notice during examination of your pathology report, if there are things that are in uncertain or kind of in question during the official diagnosis, the pathologist oftentimes will write down comments regarding where uncertainty is with regard to a particular cancer diagnosis and how they attempted to resolve those types of questions. So this could also include consulting other colleagues within, so they're not sure about a particular diagnosis, so they'll bounce it off of other colleagues to try to determine what their opinion is of that particular entity. If you as a patient have questions, you are more than welcome to contact a pathologist to help ask questions and help address any issues or questions or thoughts that you have regarding your report. Pathologists at our core are teachers, and we love trying to teach, and we want to help provide comprehensive understanding of what patients are kind of facing and what patients are dealing with. So if you have questions, feel free to reach out. Also, if you do have concerns or if your oncologist has concerns about a particular diagnosis or a pathology report, if there are questions, reach back out to that pathologist. You always have the option to go and get a second opinion to review the slides. It is very common for pathologic samples to go through multiple reviews as patients maybe go from one medical institution to another medical institution. Part of that transfer of care, pathology is involved, again, making sure that we agree with the prior diagnoses that have been made. Getting towards the question of precision medicine and what technologies we utilize to determine basically underlying mechanisms driving a patient's cancer diagnosis. So many of these tests basically rely upon what we call molecular testing to look at the changes in the DNA and the RNA of a particular tumor. And so again, identification of a particular change may demonstrate that a tumor could respond to a particular therapeutic. And so this example has been brought up earlier in this teleconference. So in the context of chronic myeloid leukemia, the identification of the Philadelphia chromosome, which produces a protein product called BCR-ABLE, basically enables that particular patient to be treated with a certain therapeutic called imatinib to help target and block the activity of that protein. On the flip side, knowing the presence of certain mutations can be helpful in preventing exposure of patients to therapies that aren't going to work. So, for instance, in certain lung cancers, there are mutations in the EGFR gene, which can lead to resistance in particular class of tyrosine kinase inhibitor. However, dependent upon the mutation that we identify, maybe there's a different generation of tyrosine kinase inhibitor that may be effective in that patient. So more comprehensive testing has become more common in recent years. Historically, when this field kind of first got going, single genes were assessed individually. So one gene per test tube, per one test. And so it was took a long time. It was very tedious, and we didn't really have a good grasp at what things we might be missing. Towards the middle of the 2010s, larger next-generation sequencing panels started becoming more common, with up to 50 genes being fairly regularly ordered. And now today, large panels examine hundreds to thousands of genes all off of one sample, again, to assess the biologic drivers driving that patient's disease process. Additionally, in addition to the DNA that's assessed in these large panels, we can also look at RNA-based studies, looking at gene expression, so which genes are actually turned on. And again, this information can be useful in helping determine which therapies may work best. So in order to actually look at the status of these genes, molecular pathologists utilize technologies called next-generation sequencing, or as I think is a better description of what's going on, it's called massively parallel sequencing, to look at all of these individual gene elements simultaneously. So there are two major flavors of next-generation sequencing technology. One of them is called Illumina. The other one is called ion torrent sequencing. And these utilize different aspects of the biochemistry that our bodies utilize to help determine what the raw sequence of the genome, so which individual letters and what order are those letters are present within that targeted area. And so then based upon the raw reads that we determine, we can actually align those reads back to a reference sequence and see which things are different and could those differences actually be impacting a patient's disease process. So overall, these studies can help to inform for the patient's best next steps, what therapies may work, which therapies may not work, and overall can help inform the best way forward for a patient given their circumstances. So overall, pathology in general plays a key role in establishing the diagnosis of a patient and helps to lay out potential paths forward for treatment of the patients that we serve.
Thank you so much, Dr. Cox. That was a superb presentation, really quite stellar, and really helps to define for the participants and for all of us a better understanding of the important role of the pathologist, really, who really looks more carefully at the cellular level, molecular level, and then helps to determine best treatment. And so it's really wonderful, just wonderful to understand that for our participants, and to also know they have access to a pathologist when they get a report to talk to the pathologist directly. It's really amazing. So thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And I'm just going to say a minute about just Cancer Care Services. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization. We provide a host of services to people. Many people in the United States call our HOPE line, 800-813-4673, or people may visit our website at www.cancercare.org. So what do we actually do? So people often call the HOPE line, and they often call with a specific question, like, I need help with transportation costs, or I need co-payment assistance with my cost of treatment, or I need to talk with someone for support. And so usually those issues are the social worker who answers the phone, because they are all in queue to answer the phone, so no one has to wait to speak to someone. We have about 40 social workers. They will address the question, and then we'll go over with them some of the other services that we offer. So what are all those free services and programs? So we do offer financial assistance, co-payment assistance, and food insecurity, helping people with the food as well. We also do have a number of online support groups, and they're for all ages and for both people living with specific types of cancer and also for caregivers, partners, young adults. So our website really gives a very clear picture of that as well. We also offer, of course, these workshops, about 70 or 80 a year of these on different either types of cancer or different topics, like today is more a topic on precision medicine. We also have a number of publications that you can access and download from our website. So that gives you a quick picture of all the services we offer. We also do offer patient navigation. So if we don't have the service, we have a team of people who will work with you to get you the service that you need. So if we don't offer it, we'll find either a national organization or something in your city or state or regionally that can help you. And we'll stay with you until that need is met. So that gives you a just quick picture of the services that we offer. And now we're going to move right on to the Q&A. And I'm going to ask Regina to explain to all of you, well, to first of all bring all the speakers on board, and also to ask Regina to explain to you how to queue up and ask a question.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So this question is for Dr. Saltz. What is liquid biopsy used for testing? When is liquid biopsy used for testing?
Biopsy is a fancy word for a blood test. Sometimes it's hard to get tumor, but it's usually pretty easy to get a tube of blood. And so if, for example, somebody has had surgery and there's a significant amount of tumor available, then it's often easy to get material to do the kinds of molecular analyses we've talked about. But sometimes somebody may have just had, say, a small biopsy done on a colonoscope or an endoscope, or a biopsy that had only a small amount of tumor in it, a needle biopsy perhaps, or perhaps somebody had their surgery at another hospital, is now in a different hospital or a different city or a different country, and it's difficult to get access to the tissue in order to do the analysis. That's where a liquid biopsy may be a good alternative, because we don't have to go tracking down tissue or doing an invasive procedure to subject somebody to additional biopsies. Other places where you might consider liquid biopsies are in situations other than colorectal cancer, those tumors where there are emergent changes, where new information might open up different treatment options. So if one is going to need serial monitoring of the mutational changes, it's certainly easier to do a series of blood tests than a series of tumor biopsies.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. And this question is for Dr. Cox. Does precision medicine only look at genetic mutations, or does it include other forms of variation?
So precision medicine can encompass a lot of different areas. So in addition to the genetic changes that we kind of talked about, and that's usually the things that we think of mostly, we can also incorporate different proteins that are expressed by the tumors that can be determined not through genetics but through studies called immunoperoxidase stains. So one of the discussions that one of the speakers had earlier was the discussion of mismatch repair, or MMR. So when we have a colon cancer, for instance, we'll actually perform special stains on the tissue itself to determine if these proteins are retained or if they're lost. And so if we determine that they are lost, then we can automatically kind of jump to this patient should respond well to something like an immunotherapy, or also known as a checkpoint inhibitor. So DNA and RNA studies are probably the poster children for precision medicine, but it's not the end-all be-all.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Cooper. What is the possibility the microsatellite instability changes as the tumor progresses? What about the tumor burden?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a really good question. In lung cancer, we don't think so much about the mismatch repair or the microsatellite instability that's seen more actually in the colon cancer realm. But in lung cancer, we talk about something called tumor mutational burden, which I'm not sure if that's what the question is getting at. But in tumor mutational burden, basically, it's kind of hitting at the same idea that there's a lot of changes within the tumor that sort of show a lot of foreign proteins to the body, basically, and gives the sense that immunotherapy might be a good match for that tumor, because there's a lot of foreign protein that tells the body, like, oh, this is something unusual and you should attack it. But we don't really think about that in lung cancer so much, and we are not sure about how tumor mutational burden evolves over time. That's a really good question.
If I could just make a quick comment on that,
sure.
Because I think some of that question may be more apropos to GI cancers like colon cancer or even upper GI cancers. Mismatch repair deficiency or proficiency or MSI is something that's kind of an early issue in the development of the cancer, so it's not really something that we would realistically expect to change. We'd like to see it in a tumor because it opens up the opportunity for immunotherapy that otherwise isn't there. But if it's not there, it's not going to be there, and retesting isn't going to find it.
Excellent. Thank you. And I just want to actually correct my introduction for Dr. Morrow. Dr. Morrow is Director, Chronic Myeloid Leukemia Program Member, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Cornell Medicine. So this is a good question for Dr. Cooper. Are there ongoing clinical trials that specifically look at precision medicine?
In lung cancer? Oh, yes. Oh, goodness. That is sort of, that's where the field has sort of 100% evolved with lung cancer, that basically we really can't make an informed treatment decision for a patient until we are able to say that we've done a number of different tests on the tumor, to understand, just as Dr. Saltz was saying, what is possible treatments for a patient and what treatments might not make sense to give. And so that's really how we're evolving our deeper understanding. So as far as clinical trials that exist right now, are a number of clinical trials for each of the mutations which have been discovered to be targetable in lung cancer. So newer agents, besides the drugs that we already have for those mutations, but also those antibody drug conjugates that I was talking about have new targets against lung cancer, and only one of them is currently approved. The rest of them are all sort of in the clinical trial realm, and we're still talking about them quite avidly. So, those trials are ongoing, and a number of trials are sort of being compared against standard of care. So certainly feel free to reach out to me with any specific questions, but oh, yes.
Excellent. Thank you. And a question for Dr. Saltz, has precision medicine been shown to be more effective in treating specific kinds of cancer, or has progress been made across the board?
I think that, as you heard from Dr. Cooper, lung cancer is an area where a lot of targets have been proven to be beneficial. And so there are more and more options that are open to patients because of the use of this kind of precision medicine. In the digestive tract cancer world, colon cancer, stomach cancer, pancreas cancer, and so on, we haven't made as much progress, but we certainly made important progress. Going back perhaps to the last question, one of the ways that we make that progress is by clinical trials that are driven by precision medicine. It used to be that we would not really have a great understanding of how some of our drugs worked, and we would be doing early drug development in just a generic group of patients with cancer who needed a new idea. Now what we tend to do is develop the drug in a precise fashion. So a drug will be developed because it's able to hit a new potential target, one that isn't in routine clinical practice now. And then we look on these multi-gene panels to find the patients that have this target that is not clinically relevant today, but we hope this new drug may make it clinically relevant tomorrow. So in the world of colorectal cancer, often when we've used the drugs that we have proof of benefit for and are looking for some good ideas to help patients who are otherwise running out of good ideas, we'll use these precision next-generation sequencing panels to perhaps find a target for a new drug that might be in research development. So, again, a complicated world, not a simple answer to your question, but I hope that gives you an overview.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Saltz. And Dr. Morrow, can you discuss precision medicine, clinical trials, and blood cancers?
Sure. So that's a broad question, but I try to, in my 7 or 10 minutes, describe that most blood cancer trials try to characterize cancer subtype, of course, chronic, acute, the cell of origin, and as many features as we possibly can. And as Dr. Saltz just mentioned, we may have set a good example with a trial called Beat AML, where we looked for specific precision targets. And we can often get started with some treatment, but then maybe add a targeted therapy to a backbone of a add a precision drug on top of a tailored or targeted regimen for a patient based on their age and their general leukemia. So clinical trials in leukemia really try, because of the rapid development of diagnostics and sequencing, and also because of somewhat the evolution of leukemia, it can change over time. If it goes into remission and then if it returns, sometimes it has different characteristics, so we have to sort of take a fresh look at it each time.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thanks. And I'm going to ask our speakers to provide a takeaway for all of you from today's program. So I'm going to start with Dr. Saltz and Dr. Morrow, Dr. Cooper, Dr. Cox. So, Dr. Saltz, do you want to go first?
Sure. Well, again, the focus today has been on the concept of precision medicine, which is really just using state-of-the-art technology to understand the specific nature of the particular patient's cancer so that we don't try to do a one-size-fits-all, but rather an individualized care, understanding that two colon cancers may look the same under the microscope, but one person's may be driven by one mutation, one person's may be driven by another mutation, and those can lead to different potential treatment options. This way, we can maximize the chance that when we give a drug to a person, it's going to have the desired effect.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Morrow?
Sure. My takeaway would be to remind all of us that how important research is. We've all alluded to research in the pathology lab and the clinics for lung and colorectal leukemia and all cancers. A lot of times we have to ask what I would call very basic questions. May we keep extra material from your biopsy, from your liquid biopsy, from your blood, so we can do research? May we do a broader genetic panel to look at your tumor or your cancer type, and to better understand it? That material is so valuable and so helpful. So I want to encourage patients and providers, and us as, you know, as, patients and caregivers, and us as providers, really to always strive to get as much as we can out of those precious samples. Don't be afraid to ask what they're going to be for and how they're going to be and help you or someone else. But remember that research has driven the developments we've seen today, and these lovely terms we can use, such as targeted and precision medicine.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Morrow. And Dr. Cooper?
Yeah, thanks so much. Really echo what the previous two speakers have said, and then just in general, really would encourage people to be empowered to ask, to understand, you know, exactly what testing has been done, how it might provide future avenues or opportunities for matched treatments, or how does it predict potentially how their tumor might respond. You know, a lot of times we really don't know at the outset how a particular patient is going to do when we're recommending a therapy, but we're trying to use our best guess, and that's sort of what the role of precision medicine is helping us refine and hone our best guess to be closer to the target, really. And so really feel free to just discuss with your doctors, you know, how they've arisen at the decisions that they've made, and how can they explain them better to you.
Excellent. And Dr. Cox?
Yeah, and echoing off of the comments that have already been made, so much of the changes that have kind of occurred with the access to medical records, the access to notes and things like that, are really there to help empower patients, empower their families, to help ask questions so that way they can kind of understand what they're facing with their diagnosis. You don't have to just communicate with your oncologist. You don't just have to communicate with your surgeon. But again, pathologists are available to you, again, to help kind of you understand what's going on and how the that we've seen may help impact your care.
Excellent. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've really been phenomenal, I have to say, just in terms of all the information and also the fact that we were able to identify particular cancers to focus on, knowing that precision medicine, of course, affects other cancers as well, and they will be discussed in future programs. But I also want to thank our participants for actually asking such great questions. And that was a combination of both the speakers and the participants that made today's program so special. However, I do want to comment that because of the number of people on the call today, we weren't able to take all of your questions. And some of your questions, So we will be doing more programs, of course, with this topic in mind. And so I do want to comment on, for those of you who asked a question or have a question in queue that you didn't get to ask, or those of you who are thinking of a question, I would suggest that all of you take your questions back to your treating healthcare team and your pathologist as well, and really ask the questions. Remember, you've learned things today. So take what you've learned today and bring this back to your treating healthcare team. That's really so important. Also, another thing that I've been trying to stress lately on a lot of the calls is, you know, people seem to have issues in reaching their physicians evenings, weekends, and holidays. So be sure that you actually do check with your healthcare team as to when you can reach them during those times. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.